Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, I'm Paco Romain.
I'm George Chen, and you're listening to SupDoc, a podcast that is about documentaries, our favorite thing.
And today we have comedian Scott Simpson on to talk about the 2016 documentary, A Genuine Forger.
Or Un Vrai Faussaire, if my 8th grade French is still correct.
This doc profiles Guy Reeves, one of the world's most notorious art forgers. For over 3 decades, Reeves scored major deals selling works by Picasso, Matisse, and other legends with a twist. He painted the works himself.
There's fake heirs, ruthless dealers, and more, all in this documentary. And we talk about the current state of comedy, Paco getting conned, and how we want our con men to be part Robin Hood.
As our guest stated, I love art, fakes, and con men. Great foragers are all three. Scott Simpson is a comedian based in San Francisco, but his career started in the corporate world. He helped create and run the Apple iTunes podcast store and later did the same with iBooks.
Now he's a full-time comedian and performer. His show, You Look Nice Today, received the Podcast Awards for Best Comedy Podcast. He produces the most popular independent stand-up show in San Francisco, Cheaper Than Therapy, which, until recent events intervened, entertained over 500 comedy fans per week.
Which I can attest, it's an awesome, awesome show. Hopefully we'll be able to do it again, and you'll be able to see it someday very soon.
Make sure to listen to You Look Nice Today's new incarnation, California King.
And now, here's Scott. And we welcome our guest, Scott Simpson. Thank you, buddy, for joining us on SupDoc.
Thank you guys for having me. I'm so excited.
Well, and we are equally excited. And you brought us A Genuine Forger, a delightful Amazon Prime documentary about, guess, it's about forging.
That's right. It's not one of those beat around the bush titles.
No, they
it's
get right to
title
it.
That they tell you what it's going to be about, and then they make it about it. It's so good. Did you guys watched it?
No.
Oh, yeah, nice.
That's the format of the show, is like you just explain it to us.
Oh, great.
Recap it all.
So the recap is, it's very simple. The movie is called A Genuine Forger. It's about one guy. His name is Reeves. He's a Frenchman, and he's so French. Like he's almost cartoonishly, caricaturistically French. His dad runs a bordello. And is a murderer. His mother is a fortune teller. He grows up in this crazy milieu, and then ends up getting
French word.
Ends up getting into the seedier side of art. Finds that he has a talent for it. Starts to forge. Well, he doesn't. I don't know if even forgery is the right word, because he's not copying paintings. He's doing paintings in the style of these famous artists, and he finds that he can work with other folks on the not legal side of things to distribute them out into the world. And by the end, we learn that hundreds of these fake paintings with that he's done are out there. He's been arrested and tried for some, but there are still a bunch out there. And he himself is sort of an amazing con artist genius.
Yes.
Yeah, like his versatility of styles of all the different things they show. Here's one thing I will say is a little bit of a bait and switch. Like the cover for the documentary on Amazon Prime is of the Vermeer girl with the pearl earring, which shows up nowhere in the film. It is like a blatant, like, speaking of a ripoff, like that is a that was a bait and switch by the, maybe they were just like, people think Scarlett Johansson's in this movie, I think is maybe what they thought.
But he is very French. You're right. I mean, he has at least 30 different pipes from my count.
So many pipes.
He has many pipes, many hats, and
many women.
Many women. And even like, it's funny because like you brought up like the seedier side of the art world. Who knew that there was a seedier side of the art world? Who knew? Did you know this before you watched this doc, Scott?
Well, just on his Frenchness, my favorite thing about his Frenchness is that wonderful French aptitude for mouth sounds. and
right.
And all of those just wonderful interjections that they use that we just throw an in and they're whistling away while they're thinking of the
onomatopoeia.
Next word.
Oh, it's the best. Like full Foley sounds. Like Michael Winslow is actually French, is what it is from Police Academy.
This is very
The bordello.
This is very God. let's dig into that. Let's dig into mom and dad Reeb. So you brought up the fact that very early on we find out his genesis is in a whorehouse. He grew up in a whorehouse, and I love how he described like the daily functions of the whorehouse too, where he was like, you know, the women would cook, they would clean, they would help us out with their homework, then they'd wash their ass and get to work, you know, like. Oh, at least they had a spreadsheet of like chores. Do they have
the chore wheel at the whorehouse?
They had a chore wheel at the whorehouse.
Not to denigrate sex work, but domestic work and sex work. It's a chore wheel. Yeah,
that's right. Definitely. Today might be domestic. Tomorrow might be sex. It's still work, and it is legitimate.
Exactly.
Just a wheel for it.
Yeah, I mean, the dad seemed like a real piece of shit. Like, that is piece of merit, as I would say. Like he also later, what was the deal? They sent him away. He had to hide from his dad and get scraps of food from his mom, who was like doing fortune telling shit. Also amazing.
I think
the mom was like a fortune teller.
I think that the tone often that we might miss of these stories is that this guy's growing up in post-war, I think Paris. I don't remember if they mentioned a city.
It's the 40s, right?
So it's post-war or mid-war, like wartime depression Paris. So the city is ruined. It's poor. It's dirty. It's rough living. Now we think of Paris as kind of like epitome of culture and class and money. But then it was trash, and I'm sure they had very little money. And they sent him to the Navy. And then he came home. I like he really narrates this particular story in a very passive voice. He's like, I come home, I see my father with a gun and three dead neighbors. Then I had to join the Foreign Legion.
Yeah. Then I'm off to the Foreign Legion. Yeah, that's there's not much else that he talks. I mean, it's like, what happened? What was his dad doing? Why three dead neighbors and him standing there with a gun?
He's like a pimp, so presumably that might have something to do with it.
Oh, yeah, he's getting this money.
But Scott, have you guys been to Paris or Paris?
I have not.
I have. Yeah, I have. I went 3 years ago for a couple of weeks. My wife and I, when we travel, I don't know how you guys do it, but when we travel, we don't tour places, like see one place for a day and then get on a bus, and we just fucking sit in the same place for we steep in a place.
Okay,
you're anchored in.
I like that.
We anchored in. So we had a wonderful time. It's I don't know if you know this. It's a pretty cool city.
Yeah.
I wish I'd seen. I remember walking by the Louvre and just like being like, the line is insane. I don't have time to do this. Which is like, I've been in Paris like once really for like 48 hours or something, and I really didn't get to do enough stuff. When I was there, I didn't see any art stuff. Do you see a bunch of art stuff? You know how big of an art head you were, Scott? This is a surprising thing for me. I wasn't sure what you were. I picture you as like a Helvetica guy. The thing that you would pick.
You can tell from my Warby Parkers that I might be more inclined.
A Helvetica man. You're a big art head? Or is that like you go to museums all over the place?
I love art very much. And I do go to museums. It's kind of my, when I travel, it's such an easy way to spend a day. And I'm sure that you guys have versions of this, whether it's a record store or a bookstore, but sometimes I'll go to a museum, not necessarily even to see a bunch of things at once, but just to kind of think in a new setting. And So I'll go and I'll wander. I'll see a couple. I don't feel particularly obliged to see everything. You get access to a clean toilet in the middle of downtown Cleveland.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's always helpful. That's why I originally bought a membership to SF MoMA. There's no good place to go to the bathroom in downtown San Francisco. I have my own. It's not labeled with my name, but it might as well be.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Burying the lead on your desire to be an art aficionado. It's more about pooping than it is about. Yeah.
That was you that pissed in the urinal, the Duchamp urinal.
Famously,
that was Scott. That was
famously.
Yeah. Oh wow! The MoMA's pretty good. SF MoMA's pretty good. That's a pretty good museum. I like that one. I've been there. I just went and saw the Magritte exhibit. Last year, I guess it was.
Oh,
6 months ago.
Yeah.
That was awesome. I'm surprised I'd never heard of this guy. I mean, he's basically forged or whatever he's doing, like, let's call it 1,000+ works of art and made he almost can't believe anything he says, but it sounds like he made a few million.
Yeah.
Up to $10 million on selling lots of forgeries, and then he just blew it all.
Yeah.
Which, like, I couldn't like this guy anymore.
I know. It's there are like 7 different strands in this documentary that I love. The first one is art. The second one is fakes. Maybe most of all, my favorite thing is con artists are lovable. It's the one, or maybe one of the few crimes where the criminal is definitely the hero, or at least the cool person.
Oh, right. Always the cool person. I mean, we meet one of the people he conned later on in this documentary. he is not the cool person in this story.
No, he's a human Burberry scarf.
He is. Yeah, he's a poet and not very smart, according to Guy Reeves, our protagonist. And this is like high-minded con forgery stuff. This isn't like trying to like pass a $2 bill or something. Like, this is like, this guy has true fucking talent. But doesn't it begs the question, and I'm sure this gets asked a lot for this kind of stuff, but why not just like paint on your own? I mean,
yeah,
why not just try and just, because he's obviously really fucking good.
He sort of answers it about 2/3 of the way through when he says, you just tell me what you want and I'll make it for you. An artist, that's what I want, and now I got to sell it to you. A forger, I just make what you want and then it sells. I think he gets the joy of making something because, again, he's not copying. He's genuinely creating. And at the same time, he's making money and just sort of funneling his work into this channel of criminal forgerers. It's the best. Oh.
Yeah, I guess it's that thing of like, you can't, his whole thing is like, everyone was okay with it to a certain point, right? Like, everyone was like making money and everyone was happy until it, like, the prices got too high and people started getting salty about like, well, that was my entire life savings. This is just this dude.
That's right.
But it sounds like there was another level, which was a certificate level, which was also like the thing that legitimized everything. It's sort of like, yeah, the fence is kind of the important person in a lot of these people. It's about distribution still. That's the thing. It's like, he's just sitting there and still a distribution problem. This is like a supply chain problem.
Absolutely. It's business to business, baby.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. When you make a ton of money illegally, then you have to launder it. It's like the drug cartels sitting on mountains and mountains of cash. Great. What are you going to do with it?
It's like running bringer shows, you know? You just got to have all this money. You got to cycle through.
That's right.
And like convince people, like the Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. I think I read some other thing where he did try to do his own paintings when he was younger. And then this was just the thing that made money. And we've all been there, right? We've all covered another comedian's sets and jokes, right? We've all done that. Just changed some words around. That is the thing. Like, he's really good. I think the word they use a lot is pastiche, which I don't technically know that what pastiche is. Scott, does anyone, Scott, do you know? Is a pastiche like taking the inspiration?
In the context of this one, it's sort of taking pieces from X and applying it to Y and Z. So if you want your Picasso pen and ink of Don Quixote or a bullfighter, he'll take a Picasso that's got the bullfighter and the crowd, and then he'll transfer an element of it and essentially mix and match, I think, is what is the best definition in this context.
Right. I like that you said X, Y, and Z, because it reminds me of one of my favorite things from this film, which is when they decide to redact something.
Oh, so good.
They do it in the most... Actually, I think this is actually a clip. It's going to be in French, but I think we should just play a snippet of this so you know what we're fucking talking about. This is just a snippet of X and Z.
Pourquoi j'ai passé des Picasso? Il y en a qui sont passés, moi. Parce que c'était la bande de... Qui mieux placé que pour aller planter un Picasso à la... Surtout une période qu'elle connaît pas. Qui avait une réputation de courtier honnête, droit, alors que c'était le roi des enculés.
Yeah, so X and Z are a dog sound and a chicken sound. And also, that kind of goes with the other things. Whenever there's a painting, they want to talk about it, but they can't show it to us. It's just this big blob of pixels. They're really like, even though it's like, if you had the magazine that they're talking about, you could figure it out. But I like to imagine that he was just painting a bunch of Japanese genitalia.
That's the only other place where I've seen so much of the mosaic effect.
Who are they protecting? I don't understand. Like, are they protecting the people that purchased that art? Why are they pixelating it?
I don't know. Yeah, I think the dealers?
Yeah, the owners, the current owners.
The owners, yeah.
And anyone who's involved in the potential sale of these works, because, as he says, they only got him for 50, right? Even though however many he's made, which according to him is hundreds, and which is certainly more than 50, there are way more of these, of his versions of Picasso and Laugier and whoever else out there. So anybody for whom this is contested, then their net worth, or certainly the worth of this painting, goes from $250,000 or $7 million to $0.
Right.
Or at least becomes embroiled in a long legal issue.
Yeah. I see. So they're pixelating it so whoever might own that doesn't lose the value of that art or something.
That's right. And the makers of the documentary, I think, don't want to be at all held responsible. I'm assuming in Europe it's way easier to be held responsible. And the
right. Yeah. That makes sense.
X and Z are like big time dealers. It's sort of implied that like the filmmakers must know who they are. Like, they're pretty big names. I mean, you can just kind of imagine, like, I don't know, like a big art dealer or a big celebrity, and they've got like hundreds of these things. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think it's the highest sale of a painting to date is the $450 million sale of the Salvatore Mundi, the Da Vinci, which is currently reported to be hanging in Mohammed bin Salman's yacht. Somewhere in the fucking Adriatic. And that, which is, you know, which sold for $450 million, is contested. It might not be real.
Right.
So this is rife throughout art, from the highest to the lowest levels.
It's a total, like, art is like, the art market is a total weird, like, money laundering world anyway, to start with. Like, it's very few things are legit in the fine art world. Actually, I mean, this is like, the scene where he's going around looking at more like modern abstract art, I thought was pretty funny. It'd be like, I mean, like, I was kind of wondering if he was going to even like any modern art, but he's just like admires technique, I guess, of new types of painting. But yeah, no, the whole thing is like so like inflated, especially like the more like people we think of since like the 80s, like all they do is they have assistants doing their craft for them anyway, right? It's
right,
like
right.
factory line type stuff. Like who the I want to say what who's the guy?
Coons is
yes.
a famous one.
Yeah. It's just like a bunch of workers actually do the work. It's all conceptual stuff. So
but it's that sort of factory mentality, and there's Ai Weiwei too, who's another conceptual guy mm-hmm. who has a factory. But there are painters now who use that kind of assistance technique. I forget the guy's name. Is it the guy who did Obama's portrait?
Oh.
Might be. If it's not him, it's one of the folks who does that sort of like very floral, predominantly African-American paintings. He's got like a factory in China where they just they crank out the backgrounds. He does the portrait. He's obviously a great artist and he's doing legitimate work. And there are so many erosions though of what we think of as the classic artist pouring their soul out, cutting their ear off. We're so deeply, deeply far from that at this point. Yeah. I think it's great because I don't care about value. Well,
I think like in 2020 now, where we basically have gotten to see behind the curtain of everything, politics, race, class, you know, like why not like just throw the fucking art world in there too and just show it for what it really is. It's like a 7-course dinner, which it's really just a fucking buffet at like Pandarosa, you know, or some shit, you know, like please go ahead.
Sorry, Paco. I was just going to say, I was reading this book called The $12 Million Stuffed Shark, and it's about the modern art market, and it's wonderful.
Is that the Damien Hirst shark?
It's a reference to the Damien Hirst shark.
Yeah.
And he doesn't even say rich people. He's got the author of this book, when he talks about the people involved in the current modern contemporary, especially art market, they're called ultra high net worth individuals, UNHWs.
Whoa.
Because when we say the 1%, this is like the 0.1 of the 1%.
Right.
Who buy these things, insanely inflate their value, don't even display them. They'll put them in some weird tax free warehouse for art
or a yacht.
Burn.
Yeah, or a yacht.
Somewhere in international waters so that they can, you know, sit there as a store of value. So it's not sitting in oil futures or a bank account or something like that. And it's just this giant scam that's based on a very simple, very beautiful activity, which is one person looking at a painting.
Right. Yeah. That is a giant scam. It's interesting how much there, I feel like, there's parallels between the music industry and the like entertainment industry with this art industry. You know, there's like kind of a fake it till you make it, literally, I guess, kind of theme to it. And also just like some people without talent can get pushed ahead. People with real talent are just obscure and never get noticed until maybe after they're dead. And then you have these people that say they know what's happening and they can quantify and certificate things. You know, they're the gatekeepers, but they really don't know anything either. Like, I feel like one of his favorite things to do is get one over on everyone. Like, that's his, he's like, all these experts, they can't even fucking tell, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's like Chagall's daughter.
Yeah,
and he gets they work with this rabbi who comes and meets with Chagall's daughter, and she's like, "Oh yeah, I saw Daddy paint that 50 years ago."
Yeah,
and now it's real, and now some of these, without question, still live in, whether they're collections privately or publicly, they live there, and they're valued at Chagall's probably $10-20 million at this point, and. You know, if this comes out, then that instantly goes to zero, which it's funny because when you're looking at the painting, literally nothing has changed between minute one, when you think it's a Chagall, and minute two, when you know it's not a Chagall.
Right.
And yet the value has gone from $20 million to zero. There's nothing I can think of in the world that has that store of imaginary value that's so immediately depletable.
And that's a really good fucking point, which brings me to this, Scott. Should Milli Vanilli been canceled then? Should they were, that was
a, that's a, yeah, that's it, a, that's not a bad question. I mean, you know, if they were George, you, I'm sure you have thoughts on this. I think if they were around now, it would be a different reaction.
Well, I mean, there's a really good podcast. I think there's a Moth story of the guy who's still alive from Milli Vanilli talking about the whole thing and like how like now, you know, it, obviously every hit pop song is written by a team, right? It's all these Swedish dudes. It's all like Max Martin or whatever. So like, yeah, like I think he, as long as the attribution was correctly, actually, didn't Max Martin do Milli Vanilli? I think he did. But it's really sad what happened to that group because like the one guy killed himself basically, I think.
Yeah, torn apart.
So yeah, I think that Milli Vanilli would be, you know, reality stars now. They would have gone on to some other tertiary post initial one hit wonder stardom, you know, they'd have full careers now, I think, as people that got one over, as people that were like if like what's her face can like what that Kardashian who can claim to be the youngest self-made millionaire.
Oh, right.
Millionaire, whatever. It's like, how are you self-made? Obviously she did some stuff with what she started with, but you know, that's like Trumpy logic, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What is, I guess, the bigger, to the biggest question of all in art, which is what is authentic?
Right. Yeah.
Well, there was this like debate I was seeing on Twitter about Sarah Cooper. Do you know Sarah Cooper?
She's the comedian who.
Oh, the comedian Sarah Cooper. Yes, yes.
Trump.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not lip sync, but. Yeah.
Overdub. It is kind of a lip sync or overdub.
She started on TikTok, right? Yeah. She started doing it on TikTok using that.
And this guy, J.L. Coven, who I guess the best Trump impersonator in the world. I literally watched his video and thought he was doing what Sarah Cooper is doing, which was mouthing the words, the actual words of the audio. Oh, wow. That's how good he is.
Okay, yeah.
Super good. Mm-hmm. And then so I saw this like debate raging between like Sarah Cooper defenders and J.L. Coven defenders. And they're saying like, well, Sarah Cooper is the more talented of the two because she is meta mixing this medium. And J.L. Coven's doing this shit that's from like vaudeville times, which is old and not new. And he doesn't have any real talent. He's just a mimic.
Hmm.
Call me crazy, but I'm a fan of the original Mr. Donald Trump.
Thank you. That's what we're getting at. Let's take a break and sell more MAGA accessories. Go to our website now to order
the true authentic, the make America person.
Make America fake again. But I just think that's it. I mean, it's so interesting that can be a politicized debate, and also that people can have a conflicting emotion response to either. Like, I think a lot of people have a weird emotional response to a certain amount of like, it seems other, I'm trying to think of the word, the other human. It's non-human when
uncanny.
It's like uncanny valley. It's like, it just makes us freak out when we see people doing that kind of mimicky stuff, you know?
Well, what was the debate? I'm sorry. I missed a part of the debate where people like, were J.L. Coven people, fans, like going after Sarah and vice versa? Or is it just like a defense thing?
It's a defense. They're both kind of defending themselves. So there is one kind of big tweeter who someone put out this thing by J.L. Coven where he basically said, I hate being known as the second best because I think I'm the best.
Okay.
You know?
So he started some shit basically. Yeah.
In an interview, he was like, I should be known as the best Trump impersonator, and like not the second best person that's doing a Trump thing. And he's like, this takes actual talent. It took me years to like define, you know, to get this, because he had been doing it in his act since Trump became president, I believe, you know.
Right.
And he's saying, well, this Sarah Cooper person's literally just like, you know, mouthing the words. But and so people were saying like, you know, but it's a different, it takes a different talent skill. It's a, you know.
I don't know. So have you seen Ron Lynch's thing where he does like the animatronic Abe Lincoln? Like
it's amazing.
It's like, I think it's more talent to time. There's also this guy who we used to have perform. He's more of a performance art guy, but he would come and do talkies sometimes. And he did a lip sync thing of like the in between band banter of like from a Mayhem concert or Venom concert or something, where it's just like, all right, you know, like he's like mimics perfectly like all like the, all the mannerisms of like a drunken metal band in New Jersey, and like, but like looks kind of confused while he's also doing it, like these words are coming out of my mouth, but he's just, it's a really good like kind of lip sync tradition. But that might be more like almost even like connected to like stuff like, you know, drag lip sync and stuff like that. There's like a whole bunch of lip sync stuff that predates like this sort of TikTok video moment. So
yeah, but it just, when I was watching this, it just reminded me of that, of like the debate between like, is it real, is it fake, is it talent, is it not talent, should we give it any value or lots of value, you know, like
I have one. Here's my kind of sense of how human culture moves over time, is that we're always doing things that are far beyond our cultural sense of how to talk about those things. So things like TikTok, impersonation, what is talent, what is quality, all these people experimenting at once. And we have this kind of old monolithic sense of what creativity is and what an artist is. And meanwhile, the people who are making stuff now don't give any shits about what the definitions are. They're just doing it. You know, this is an even more simple and basic example is that maybe touches a little bit on copyright stuff is what's his name, Shepard Fairey, with the Obama photograph.
Yeah.
Like that's just an artist making something, or like Girl Talk or De La Soul when they took a million samples that they could never possibly clear. They're just making stuff. And the rest of the world, whether that's our sense of how artists should be rewarded or lauded, or whether it's legally how they should be paid, is always at least a generation behind.
Yeah, I think your sampling analogy is very apt in that sense. It's like with Girl Talk specifically, right? Like he's making stuff, or it goes back to like obviously like hip hop and everything, just like samples, and like the legal framework around samples is still totally not like figured out right now.
Yeah,
but yeah, I mean, yeah, visual art is an interesting thing to compare with this. I mean, what I was gonna say about the modern art versus like this sort of crafty or like hand like painting, like traditional painting stuff,
right,
is like I feel like all conceptual art is already a scam, and it's like everyone goes in knowing it's a scam, right? So like he was doing this in like the early 70s, I guess, late 60s, early 70s. It seems like it's more like, I think when I think of like the French art world, like that's like an exclusive world, right? So it's all about being you know, elitist, and essentially he's like, I was born in a brothel, fuck all you guys, you don't know shit from shit. And that's kind of like an appeal. The thing about, you said what you like about con men or con artists essentially is, the thing is like a great con, like your classic, your Oceans, whatever, it's like you're happy that someone got taken, right? It's that someone else was dumber than the con person, and then they're almost too embarrassed to go report themselves to the police.
Well,
that's ideally how it's supposed to work.
And again, I, you know, hate to tread on this analogy too much, but con men are basically comedians. I mean, comedians and con men share the same fucking jacket at some point. You know what I'm saying? Like you don't
elaborate.
Well, you don't want con men to punch down. You don't want Bernie Madoffs. You know, fuck Bernie Madoff.
No, that's right. That's
you want your
versions.
You want your con men to punch up. Like you want big corporations to get taken, and not like old grandmas with their $30,000 in their mattress.
I see. So what
it's
saying.
It's the same kind of thing. Point. You know, you want your con men to be kind of heroes. So if they're punching up, that's awesome. If they're punching down, fuck those guys. And it's one of those things too. I don't know if it's uniquely American or not, but it seems like we love the wink and the smile from the con man. The guy that we know is a career criminal. And he even talks about it. Like, he was a burglar. They talk about how at one point he was given He was giving tasks by a master burglar, like, go into this house, but only steal this one thing that they have, you know? And it's like, so this guy's been pretty much in this life forever, but we kind of give him a lot of slack because he's a vernacular and, like, the little wink and the smile and the pipe, and you're just like, God damn, I want to have a beer with this guy, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, so, extremely compelling dude.
Oh, my God. Just to fucking break some bread and have some scotch with this dude would be amazing. Scott, have you ever been conned?
Have I been conned? Oh, good question. Okay. I was definitely.
Do you know you have to pay? You have to Bitcoin us to be on this podcast. Also, aside, every guest does it.
Wait a minute.
Aside from your Ethereum that you're going to send us. Yeah. Have you been conned?
I was conned once, and I won't get into it too much, but basically I was asked to lend my phone to a person who needed to contact someone about purchasing something. And
okay.
Like, and then basically the next thing I knew, they were gone, and my phone was gone too. It was a real fast.
That's a fast call.
Con, but it was in the exact same mode as the bigger ones, which is you gain someone's trust really quickly by establishing that you're in it together, that you might be doing something a little bit sketchy, and that they're trustworthy despite that fact. It's amazing. I mean, I'm as a person who's genuinely not a con artist in any way constitutionally, I think I admire them even more that they're able to do that.
Yeah, it takes, you know, there is apparently in a pack of wolves, they figure out who's the most likable wolf and who's like the cutest little playful wolf, and they send them out to escort victims to the pack. There's the congenial wolf that goes out and plays with these other animals, and he's like, come over on this side, and the pack's waiting. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, there's the con man wolf that is like, I'm friendly and look at me. And it's usually small animals, cats or whatever, and they draw them in, and the rest of the pack is waiting. But
oh wow,
I know
that's depressing. I don't know why that's depressing. For some reason, I just think nature is above stuff sometimes.
Nature invented this shit, man. Yeah. That's how we got it. It's from nature for sure, man. Oh man, there's like birds that birds that will have other birds that draw other birds away, and they go and eat their eggs. And like, there's a whole like group of, you know, animals do this. But I was conned, and I had a very elaborate con that happened to me.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
I've told this story before on this podcast, so bear with me, folks, because Papa Paco's going in. But count my summers. When I first moved here, I was at this laundromat near my apartment. I had a Pat Metheny t-shirt on, a big Pat Metheny head.
I'm a well, big pet. Honestly, that's what they call a mark in the business.
here comes the pigeon. I was like, skirk, skirk. So I just moved here, and this guy came up to me. He's like, you like jazz? And I was like, I love jazz. And he's like, I am in town with a jazz band. And I was like, no way. Who? And he said, the Yellow Jackets. I'm like, I love the Yellow Jackets. And he's like, I play drums with the Yellow Jackets. And we started talking jazz for a while. And then he's like, do you play? And I'm like, I play piano. I play jazz piano. And he's like, would you like to sit in with us tonight? And I was like, get the fuck out of here. Of course, I would love to sit in with the Yellow Jackets. And he's like, great. Let me make a phone call. And I was like, okay, this is before cell phones. And I was like, cool, cool. And he's like, do you live nearby? Can I use your phone? And I was like, sure. We get all my stuff. We come back to my apartment. He makes a phone call at my apartment. And then he gets off and he says, hey, the band is cool with you sitting in, but because we're a professional jazz band, you have to be part of the union to play with us.
Oh, wow, wow, wow.
And this is in my apartment, in my living room. And I say, what do I have to do?
Of course you do.
Yeah,
I do too.
Exactly. And he said, as luck would have it, you can get a one-day union card for the small price of $500. You can get a one-day union card, and I just happened to know where to get that. And I was like, "Let's do it!" I'm like, "This is going to be awesome." So we get a cab, and we go to the Mission, And I go to the Bank of America in the Mission on 16th Street, and we walk in. I get $500 out. He says the union thing is just two blocks away. We go two blocks away. He gets out of the cab, gets into this place, runs into this place, comes back out, and is like, you're all set. And I was like, oh, my God, this is awesome. And I was like, do I need the card? And he's like, no, I just put your name down with the band, and it's all good, and you have this. And I was like, this is And then he's like, I got to go. I got to get back. I got to like rehearse and stuff. And I was like, I'm going to go home. I'm going to eat and take a shower and I'll meet you at the place. And he said, meet us at this hall. We're playing at this hall. And it was like the Czechoslovakian Knights of Columbus Hall or something on Petro Avenue. And so I get showered and I eat and I'm practicing my scales and stuff. And I'm super excited. I get to this hall at 8 and I'm like there and I'm like, huh. This seems kind of empty. And I'm knocking and I'm knocking and knocking and knocking on this door. There's no answer. There are no cars. I can't hear anyone like rehearsing, but I think like maybe it's kind of like, you know, deep inside and someone still has to open it. And as I'm knocking, I look to my right and this guy walks up and this guy has a guitar in his hand and he says, are you with the Yellow Jackets?
Oh,
I was like, no, are you? And he's like, no, I got a 1-day union pass to come sit in with the band. Oh. And I was like, me too. And then we were both looked at each other like, there's no band here. It was like, oh, fuck, we both got conned.
Well, you know what's amazing about that story, Paco, is that there's an extra element of cruelty there. He didn't have to send you both to the same place.
That is true. He was probably watching. He was probably counting his money and watching us meet, you know? So that was welcome to San Francisco. I'd been here for like a month when this happened. Wow.
It seems like a kind of a con prone place.
Oh, San Francisco, this city was built on cons,
right? Yeah. It's in the spirit of the city, and also just the size and the density and the types of people that rub shoulders in San Francisco.
Oh yeah,
is the highest and the lowest in the same place. So you can I love knowing that you were being conned as you told that story, because it seems so incredible. But the truth is, when you're in it and you've bought the soup that they're selling.
Yeah.
Why I said soup.
That sounds delicious.
It all tastes good. When you're eating their soup, it does not taste like fake soup.
No. Oh, well, the fact that he was in my house, like he was so nice. And he had all of the right carrots that he put in front of me. He knew exactly what to put in front. He massaged my ego. Like, he had all the right things to ask. He knew all this stuff about music, you know. There was no internet. I mean, barely an internet at this time. This was in 97. So I couldn't come home and type in Yellow Jackets San Francisco to see their tour dates or anything, you know.
But that's random that there's like two huge Yellow Jackets fans that he runs into on the same day, like, yeah, well, together.
I don't know if that guy, if he had been the same day or just like he'd been setting up people, yeah, you know, kind of thing. But because I didn't actually even talk to the guy afterwards, we just kind of left with like the fucking Charlie Brown sad song.
But that was your soulmate, Paco. That was your soulmate. The other guy who got taken, you were supposed to start a keyboard and guitar band.
Holy shit, we were.
That was given the story of like, well, how did you guys meet? That's the best band meeting story ever.
Oh my God, you're right.
We were swindled into the band together.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Sad Sacks. Put your hands together for the jazz
trio. Gullibles.
The Gullibles. Yeah, exactly.
Gullibles Travels, yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah, so that's my con story. It's afterwards I was like, all right, $500, that was worth it for this story, I guess.
It's one of the great things about being a comedian is when bad things happen. Minutes in to the bad thing happening, you're like, well, at least I got something to talk about.
Well, then there's that. Then there's the pay-to-play bullshit in the comedy world. We sold 100 tickets. It's going to be sold out, and you get there, and it's just the comedians and one comedian's girlfriend that's pissed to be there, you know? Like we've all been sold a bill of goods on what's going to happen at a comedy show, you know? I've myself driven 400 or 500 miles to do a show that I was promised was going to be sold out and I was going to make a bunch of money, and it was just like, you know, a milk crate and a horrible microphone and no one else there. So
One of the things I love about this film is that he really does list the specific cons. It's almost a how the great thing about reading about or watching con men work is that each thing is a template that can be reapplied in many situations. Like, you can become a con artist by virtue of watching or reading about these techniques. Like the one that he pulled on you is so repeatable.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I'd imagine it probably has a word in the con world. Like, oh, he pulled the pigeon on you.
Yeah,
you fell for the pigeon. Like in magic, you know, they all have words for their different reveals and stuff. Like, I'm sure con men have the same thing.
Sneaky
you know?
Pete, the Amazon Prime show Sneaky Pete. Yeah. They're always talking about, oh, what is that? A reverse crusader? What'd you do on him?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean. Yeah, and it is pretty fascinating. There was a couple things in this doc that thrilled me to death. One of them was the guy who used the woman who had the story about being a widow, who sold the paintings to the poet, who then got commission from the guy who set up the woman to set up the guy. I mean, I'm like, that's just genius.
Style. That was like the McMillian style thing where like the woman's the front, but then she didn't even really get anything. She got like a couple hundred out of it. She got really very little for her trouble. I like the fake aging system that he had in place to like fake age everything. He's like, well, there's certain ways you got to age things, but then you kind of see on the other side, they're like, well, he's using vinyl paint, and that was 20 years after this was supposed to be, right after this guy died or something. So like, he's getting caught on different things, but then his whole thing about get a dusty painting, get the frame, get the dust from the frame, it blends in with the paint. I'm like, oh my God. So when they test it, then they can, it looks like it's old paint, like that kind of level of like the amount of effort, like his whole thing of like, it takes him longer to make one of these Chagalls than it would take Chagall. It takes him longer to do. He basically, it's like reverse engineering, right? So he's learned to reverse engineer all these different styles, and it seems like in the beginning he wasn't that good, and then he kind of had this tutelage period where they were like, oh this guy, the Leon Amiel, right? Like, he's kind of basically a mafia dude, right? He alludes to a bunch of mafia shit, but he's like, I can't really get into that. I'm like, well, you've told us a lot already. Can you just go all the way and just tell us all the mafia shit?
Was this doc was pre-sentencing, right?
No, I think he did his time. He got arrested in 2010, and he was out. He basically, it seems like he got away with just the ankle bracelet.
Yeah, it was such a European sentence. They were like, given the gravity of the crime, we ask for the maximum of 3 years.
Yeah, because they were like, he's like, your painting was so good, we're going to give you 3 years. Yeah, that's, so he had like an ankle bracelet that he didn't seem to care about.
No.
You know, because he's not 20 anymore.
That's pretty much it, yeah. And then he's always thinking about his next scam, right?
I know.
I'm like, I'll just say that these were before the sentencing. Like, I made these like 15 years ago, and I already did the time for it. Yeah, basically.
Yeah. Well, and he's like, well, what are you going to do with this painting? He's like, tear it up or give it to someone. I'm going to give it to someone. I'm definitely going to give it to someone.
Holding in for our eyes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, like, once a con man, always a con man. I think this shit is in the DNA. And one of the things that I love about con artist stories is the multiple plates that they have to have in the air at all times. Like, it's so tiring. Like, this guy.
Yeah, it's work.
It's so much work. When again, it's kind of the thing with like any con man. It was like, if you actually just had done it legitimately, it would have been a lot easier. You have the talent. People would have, you know, may or may not have dug it, but like, you spent your entire time lying and spinning plates and getting 50-year-old dust to like, mix in with the paint.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's a relief when you're caught.
Gotta be. But these guys are psychopaths, so there's no reconciliation. They're not sorry though, because they're, like you said, they're already thinking about, they're like, whew, okay, great, I got caught, when's my next you know, like, now I know what to do.
Yeah.
Did you guys see the film? It's a fiction film that came out a couple years ago. Can You Ever Forgive Me? That's what this reminded me of, which is about a woman who was forging like literary signatures. And like, she was like
letters, right?
Letters. Ephemera. She was like, yeah, she was forging ephemera and she was so good at it. And it just was like this, she had a partner. It all kind of fell apart. It was Mariel Heller made the film. It's really interesting story, but it reminded me of this story a little bit. But then, again, this guy's like not repentant at all. With the Can You Ever Forgive Me, she ends up like writing, she writes a book about it, and then it's like her talent is like in how she writes about the entire thing. She was like a writer who would basically her nonfiction, like she'd write biographies of like actors and stuff, and then like it just wouldn't go anywhere. So then this became her side hustle. That became the main thing. It was very similar in the sense of like it was ripping off a bunch of New York literary people who doesn't want to rip off those people, you know?
So right.
That's still a punching up scenario. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Collectors. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's always interesting when people are able to spin their con and their crime into a legitimate business afterwards that kind of plays off of what they did. Like hackers getting jobs.
Like white hat hackers or something.
Yeah, like they're given jobs then to look for security problems or like even JT LaRoy, you know, and that whole con, you know, being like, oh yeah, you got me, now I'm gonna sell my story, and you know, like it's a very interesting, you know, I would crumble under any cross invest, you know, cross examination.
I'm so sorry.
I did it, and I'm so sorry. And then I would immediately give away all my secrets because I'm just a blabbermouth, you know, like I would not do well. I am this body was not made for prison. I am so soft, you know.
I couldn't
possibly go. But there are some. Yeah. Have you seen The Imposter, Scott? Have you ever seen that documentary?
Which one is that?
It involves a French person also.
Yes, it does.
Who pretends to be a missing boy from Texas. It's pretty bonkers. Oh, have you seen it?
Yes. My wife watched it, and she's very good at describing documentaries and other films that she watches to me. I'm going to go ahead and
bring her on the show. Bring her on the show. Let's bring her on the show.
Yeah. So it's as if I've watched it. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. It's really good. And it's also the same kind of thing where it just seems exhausting because of all the stuff he has to do. All this stuff you have to do. It's like, it's not for people like can you be lazy and be a good con man? I'm putting this out.
Ooh, that's a great question. That's a great question.
I don't think so. I think he worked really hard for like 2 weeks out of a month. And then the last half of the month, he was just blowing all the money he had. Like, what was the thing? He went to Vegas and then got millions of dollars, blew it all on the slots or something, and then they just gave him money and like, get out of here. Like, he got so many stories like that. Yeah.
It might, you know, we might think of it as work because it's consistently keeping up a character that you're not, or a number of characters, depending on who calls and what number they use to your phone today. But I think for folks like this who are, you know, their personalities are much more fluid than ours are. I think it's maybe not so much work for them. There's a great documentary that I just watched last night called, I don't know if it's great, but the story is fascinating. It's called Art and Craft. Mm-hmm. It's about another art forger.
Okay.
His whole thing, he's sort of mentally ill, but he doesn't even sell. He forges the art. Uh-huh. Then he invented like a dead sister and goes to these museums in like Mississippi, all around the South and the Midwest, and says she bequeathed this, you know, relatively famous work of art to you. They say, thank you so much. They, because he's giving it to them, like they're not going to be like, this is fake. It's got, you know, it's got a realistic looking like Christie's auctions sheet on the back. He'll dress as a number of different characters. He'll dress as a priest to further the lie. And he calls it his philanthropy.
Huh. Interesting. Wait, what? This is called what?
Arts and Craft.
That's called Art and Craft.
Art and Craft.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah, that's it. And I got into the fake stuff recently. There's another one called There Are No Fakes, which is, if you can imagine the most cartoonishly Canadian version of this story, it's what it is. It starts because a member of the band Bare Naked Ladies, purchases a painting.
Oh.
That turns out to be of questionable provenance.
Mm.
And the movie is about this guy who's this kind of, he's this native artist named Norval Morisseau, the Picasso of the North. And the movie's about that. And there's a ton of meth. And there's a lot of driving to Calgary. And it's fascinating, but it's also super trashy.
Oh, nice. Does anybody feel sorry?
Oh, there's so much sorry.
Oh, so sorry. That's awesome. Yeah. I want to check that out. I love those stories of like people dressing up in different. I just watched a very short little documentary on YouTube the other day about this guy in New York at the turn of the century that was like just wasn't really a con man, more than just like an impersonator of people that didn't exist so that he could get involved in high society. And like, he would come in and be like, I'm the undersecretary of the Navy. And they're like, well, let's give you a tour of the ship then.
Wow.
And that's pretty much all he did. And people loved him. It's kind of like Emperor Norton, the San Francisco guy, you know, like people just, there's, I think it's truly American where we kind of love those kind of wacky people. We're like, you know, you're nuts and you lie a lot, but goddamn, you got gumption, you know? Yeah. And that matters a lot.
I love that also country. You said turn of the century, and in my mind, I'm like, you mean like 1999? Is that?
Oh, right.
He's like, well, oh, I was in the Strokes. I started the Strokes. I was the fifth stroke.
You're right. Yeah. Well, one of the things that let me just put a spotlight on this then. So this guy forges great works of art. You have to have talent. But one of the things I thought that really stuck out for me is he said, you have to have soul. Like, it's not enough to just paint, and it's not enough to just mimic. You also, for the good pieces to get past everyone's discerning eyes, like, you have to have soul. Mm. And I think that is so interesting that it still matters that you feel it in your body that you're doing this, because that translates. This thing that you can't almost define still translates. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Like, Yeah, bizarre too, because the soul that they're implying it has is Chagall's or Picasso's.
Right. Well, and what a chameleon you have to be then to take on other people's souls, in a sense. That really fascinated me, because he's drawing that Matisse at the end, mm-hmm. and he's like Matisse played with light, but he also had a lot of soul. So like, it's mm-hmm. for me, it's like, I don't try to mimic too much of what the art looks like, it's more of the soul of the piece. And I was like, god damn, that's deep for like a con man, you know, like, that's pretty interesting stuff. And that's, I think, again, where it comes into like talent and the entertainment business. It's like, you can mimic someone. Like, there's a lot of Louis C.K. mimics, there's a lot of Bill Burr mimics, there's probably a lot of Ali Wong mimics now. It's like, it's all fine and good, but if that fire in you isn't translating, if that soul isn't coming out, then people are just going to be like, eh, you know, that's fine for a second.
One thing I was thinking about when I was watching this is just how good of a storyteller this guy is, even if he's like lying about half the stuff. It's like,
right.
He is like, it's the same way. I'm like, I don't know if I'd want to watch a fictionalized version of this, because I feel like, and any actor is just not going to do as good of a job as this guy who like either believes his own bullshit or is just like so like utterly this character all the time that like,
right.
There's no other way to capture his, like, it just was like one thing I just realized, like, about like, oh, this is like, documentaries are entertaining. This is like a good example of like an entertaining documentary, because like, you couldn't have someone act this well to do this story, you know, like,
no,
is that much of like his personality is just like so central to this thing, even though he's like full of shit. Like, right. He's definition of an unreliable narrator, pretty much. Right. Like the con man himself conning us. But
yeah.
I mean, he the way he sort of reveals everything in the super casual, like, I give no fucks way, you know, it's so French. Yeah.
Well,
and
yes, he gives no fucks until the guy asks him, do you think you stole money from these people? Then he got kind of irate.
He did get like, kind of like, yeah, and nope. A little pissy about that. Yeah.
He got a little pissy. He moved forward to kind of be like, you know, it's like, oh shit.
Pipe. He lit his pipe so hard.
Super hard. One of his 30 pipes he lit. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's very, I mean, it's truly definitely, but talking about, let's do Cast This Doc then.
Gotta cast this doc. Cotton cast this doc.
So we were just talking about you can't see this as the real, you know, the real movie. Might as well cast this. So who do you guys? I mean, I it was hard to cast anyone else other than Guy Reeves. So what do you got? Who do you got?
Scott,
I've got one. I had one guy, and then I kind of rethought about it. Because I think the person who plays this role has to be able to really pull off a cravat. not a beret. Beret's for an artist. Cravat is for a forger.
Absolutely.
So the person I think who should play him, who is a perfect combination of cravat ready and blowhard, is Fred. Do you know what's his name? Fred Malamud.
He's the Fred Malamud. Yeah, he plays Maria Bamford's agent on her show.
Yeah,
Dynamite.
Or yeah. In a World.
In a world. He's so good in a World. Yeah,
so good. Just somebody who's and he's got that kind of Gallic fleshiness to his face. He's got meaty lips, which I think
he
you
does.
Need you.
He is cravat ready too. That dude shows up on set with a cravat in hand. Yeah. That's really good. I failed to mention, Scott, when I told you about Cast a Stock, you could cast people who are dead as well. It's wide open. Yeah, they don't have to be living people.
Then I'm going to go with dead Fred Malamud.
Okay, good. Noted. What about you, George?
I just purely physically, Buddy Hackett.
Yeah, you're right. We had the same one.
Yeah, we had the same one. I knew that you and I were going to think the same thing because we're just like Apple Dumpling Gang era people. That's what all we can think of. No, I mean, just visually, he's so, like, voice, not at all. I mean, it would be hilarious if he was just like, in French, like, I ripped off a bunch of people. It was great. You know, like a fucking
that would be
seagull.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be good. I had the same one. Buddy Hackett, he looks just like him, for Christ's sakes.
Yeah.
And they probably loved Buddy Hackett in France. They love those,
they must love. They love idiots.
They love the idiots. They do. They love the idiots. So this was awesome. I'm so glad you brought this to our attention, Scott. Thank you so much for doing that and being our guest. What do you have to plug? Let's plug some stuff.
I restarted my podcast I've done forever. It's called You Look Nice Today. Our new iteration is called You Look Nice Today, California King. So if you look for that, you'll find it. It's been fun to restart.
Keep that same
times.
RSS feed. You get that old school RSS feed.
Got that fresh
yeah,
XML,
fresh
baby.
New one. Oh, okay.
Fresh new one. Okay. Yeah, I think we wanted to keep the old one's old and it's extremely edited and extremely tailored. And this one is much more loose and fun and free form and just a way to reconnect with my two internet friends from 10 years ago.
And like what? Scott is like podcast royalty. So yes. He's one of the early pioneers, one of the homesteaders of podcasting.
What year did you start? What year was your first podcast?
Back in
at the turn of the century.
I don't know. What was that came at? Maybe like 2007 was.
Oh shit.
Was the beginning. For the show, yeah, it was old. It's been around for a while. You know, what was nice about doing a comedy podcast then, it was so easy to get into festivals.
Oh right.
Oh, there were like four, and you know,
and you were at all four of them.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We did all of them because there were not everybody didn't have one.
Yeah.
This has been really delightful, though. I really appreciate it, guys.
Well, thanks, Scott. We've been wanting to get you on for quite a while, and appreciate you bringing a genuine forger to us. I enjoyed it. I always know, like, when I first start watching, if I start texting people, like, oh, you should. Like, you immediately think of a friend that is going to enjoy this doc, and you're like, my God, you should watch this doc. This is a good one.
Yeah. You're all our friends, guys. You're all our friends. Text us.
All of you sup doc people. Exactly. But thanks, Scott. And so we'll put your podcast in our show notes. And thanks for being our guest.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Hey,
Hey, thanks for listening. You can find out more about SupDoc at supdocpodcast.com.
Recapping reality since 2015.
Our theme song was written by the very talented David Siegel, and our show is engineered by the immensely talented Will Scovel. And if you want to help us out, just share the show. Let your friends know about it and let your enemies know about it.
Join the Doc Talk and check out our hot takes, pictures, and videos on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. We're SupDoc Podcast on all of those mediums.
And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. It really does help.
Find Paco and George's comedy gigs on the About Us page on the SupDoc Podcast website.
If you want to advertise with SupDoc, you got a film, you got opinions, you got corrections, hit us up. We'd love to hear from you and what you're docking out on these days.
We'd love to hear from you. Email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.